That is one of the worst. That's true.
I tell you, sounds trite.
The Senate Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. Today is Friday, March 26, 2010. We have four items on the agenda today. We're going to first start with an item that we won't be acting on. It's just for updating the committee members and discussing Senator Scheid's bill, Senate File 2736. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, thank you. Some of you, well, you, Madam Chair, I guess the person in the room who has heard this bill.
Can you pull the microphone close to you, please?
Pardon me? I'm sorry.
Put your microphone.
This bill started with the Judiciary Committee, and we were re-referred to the State and Local Committee and now to Finance. And it started with the governor's proposal for doubling the sentences for CrimSex 1 from, well, more than doubling, 144 months and up to 300. And that was the sum of that bill. And I think we had a good discussion in the Judiciary Committee about the proportionality of that, and also maybe there are other people, even at the levels of 2, 3, and 4, CrimSex 2, 3, and 4, that perhaps should be pulled into what is now would be indeterminate sentencing. And so I think, I don't
know. Hold on just a second. Members of the public who are here, this is a really hard room to hear in, especially if there are kind of side conversations. So if you feel a need to chat with people while we're doing our business here today, if you could step out into the hallway to do that, we would all appreciate it. And you will, too, because you'll find that it's really hard to hear in this room, too. So thank you for your cooperation on that in advance. Senator Scheid.
So, Madam Chair, I guess I would like Mr. Backus to walk everybody through the bill. I think he can do that more efficiently than I can. But I wanted to tell you that there's one. The reason we went to the state and local government committee was the fact that we have a special review panel when people have served their statutory, the minimum, they would be able to petition to be released, and they would go before a special review panel. You may recall, Madam Chair, that that was going to be a three-member panel consisting of the commissioner and or a representative of the commissioner and two public members with the advice and consent of the Senate. Regarding those two public members, the state and local government folks wanted to take out the advice and consent of the Senate, but they kept it in. I shouldn't say we because I don't serve on that committee, but they did change the panel to be three public members who would then make the recommendation to the commissioner. So that's the significant change for those of you who have heard this before.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Backus, would you walk us through the details, please?
Madam Chair and members, I think what I will do, is, if it's okay, is just give you an overview of the bill rather than a section-by-section summary, because I think that would be a little more understandable. What the bill does is it, well, obviously addresses sex offender sentencing. And first off, it amends the 2005 sex offender sentencing provisions that we enacted in 2005, a life without release sentencing provision and then an indeterminate life with release sentencing provision for egregious first-time offenders and for repeat offenders. So one thing the bill does is it adds to the list of offenders who are eligible for those sentences first and second-degree CrimSex offenders with victims under the age of 13. So currently, those offenders wouldn't be eligible for those type of sentences from 2005. Now they will, assuming the other elements of the sentence would be present, such as heinous elements, things like that. Then what the bill does is it creates three indeterminate sentences that are brand new. The first is an indeterminate life with release sentence, and that applies to first and second degree CrimSex offenders with victims under the age of 13 if the act is committed with force or violence. So that would be a mandatory sentence there. Then it creates two other indeterminate sentences for the following groups of offenders. First and second degree crim sex offenders with victims under 13, but where there's no force or violence. First and second degree crim sex offenders with victims 13 and older, but where the offense involves force or violence. And then third and fourth degree crim sex offenders who use force or coercion. So those groups of offenders under the bill would get either of two sentences. They'd either get an indeterminate statutory maximum sentence, or if they're a repeat offender, they'll get an indeterminate life sentence.
Thank you.
A couple quick more things. The bill provides that any offender who gets one of these new sentences who gets released will be placed on supervised release for the remainder of their lives. As Senator Scheid said, it does create this special review panel. One other important thing that the state and local committee did, though, is that they provided that essentially the decision of the special review panel is now basically a recommendation to the Commissioner of Corrections.
Correct.
The original bill, as it left judiciary, would say that they would actually make the release decision. Now the release decision is still ultimately the Commissioner of Corrections based on a recommendation from this panel. And then finally, the bill provides that any offender sentenced under any of these new sentences or the 2005 sentences are not eligible for subsequent civil commitment under the theory that these people would be addressed within the correctional system.
Thank you. And just for the record, folks who are already in prison now are sentenced to the sentence that they originally had, and there's
Madam Chair,
no way
that's correct.
Folks who are in prison now will be part of this new process going forward. Is that correct?
Did you say the people who are? No, they are not. Okay. They would not be part of this. No.
Okay. Are there any questions at this point? I know we have the fiscal note to
Well,
to
Madam
talk
Chair,
about.
And that's why the fiscal note looks so promising until you get to the out year. So, Mr. Turner
and
could.
Mr. Turner, do you want to give us the news on the fiscal note?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, we're working off of. Preliminary note should be in front of you.
It's in your packets, members.
It's 18 pages long. I'm not going to go through the whole thing.
No.
There are three tables that I think are very telling.
Yeah.
And the first one will be on page 10. And as Mr. Backus said, there are two new sentences being proposed in the bill. One is for a life sentence, and the other is for the mandatory statutory max. Table 1 on page 10 has to do with new life sentences under the bill. And it's using 2008 data, and this is a snapshot of 1 year. And if you'll look, according to the guidelines, 215 offenders will be sentenced under the provisions of this bill. The column number receiving prison, that's number that would receive prison under current law. That's 113. The next column, number receiving probation, under current law, they would now be receiving prison sentences. And so if you're looking, they'd be receiving life sentences. We've got 102 of 215 offenders who would be receiving or would be under consideration for a life sentence under this bill who are receiving probation under current law. There has been some preliminary analysis done that has found that of this universe of offenders, between 10% and 20% of them are currently being civilly committed after their criminal imprisonment. So the bill is casting quite a wide net at this point for consideration for a life sentence. Now, if we want to look at the stat max universe, that's on page 14. Once again, it's 2008 data, and it's looking at a snapshot of 1 year. There's 103 offenders that would be eligible under the bill for the new statutory max prison sentence, indeterminate sentence. Of those 183, 97 would be new sentences under this bill. Guys who wouldn't be going to prison under current law, they'd be getting probation. And then 83 would be getting longer prison sentences than they would under current law. And they determined that approximately four would be no change. So I guess what these two tables tell me is that under both the life sentence provision, the life sentence provision and the mandatory statutory max provision, about half the people under this net are people who are not going to prison under current law.
Yeah.
And the result of that shows up on page 16. Now, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission does a great job of taking very complicated ideas and crunching them down into scenarios. They come up with a range for this bill of between 480 and 3,219 prison beds. That's not too useful. So they have to make estimates, and their mid-range, when they consider all the different release scenarios, is a year-by-year prison estimate that would, under the most likely release scenario, that would result in a need for of 838 beds by the time this provision is fully implemented over the course of its life, over the course of it, the offenders being sentenced and serving their life sentence. So that if they take it out to the year 2068, we'd reach the 838 new prison bed. Okay. But we're not worried about 2038. We're worried about the immediate future. What we look at is this, under this scenario, and this is a midpoint projection, 100 new prison beds by the end of the next biennium, which at $65 a day would be $2.4 million. That would rise to 217 by 2015, which a year from now will be within our TAILS consideration. And that would be $5.1 million. And after that, we got fast TAILS, you know, year after year after year, until finally we arrive at 838. Now, part of the reason that this bill is being considered is because the Senate would like to save money for civil commitment down the line. And none of that savings is going to show up, of course, for at least 5 or 6 years, because these guys are going to go to prison before they're going to be committed anyway. But in the long run, preliminary analysis, and I think that can be honed a little better, but it looks like between 10 and 20% of this universe of offenders are being committed, civilly committed today. So you'd have to weigh the cost of imprisoning the 80% to get the 20% to incarcerate them in a prison as opposed to the sex offender program.
And, of course, the daily cost in the commitment program is over $300
a day. $312, I believe, so. Madam Chair.
And, Mr. Turner, do we believe that if we go – are we expecting something beyond a preliminary fiscal note that might have the MSOP projections?
Madam Chair, members – this note is preliminary because the courts and the public defender have not weighed in yet on this. But it's a general rule that you can infer with the higher consequences, there's going to be more court time and more court costs. Nobody can really it's difficult to project that, but that can be inferred. What is the sentencing guidelines analysis is complete, and the Department of Corrections costing is complete, and that's what I went over with for you. Now, MSOP, that there has not been a formal analysis done on this. There's been some of the people in corrections and in sentencing guidelines have looked at it and have said that of this universe, we'll pick up maybe a fifth of the guys would end up being civilly committed after being criminally imprisoned. And, of course, those we wouldn't start saving any money for at least 6 years.
Question, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason we wouldn't save the money is because the civil commitment process, according to this proposal, is going to go away. Is that correct?
No.
I mean, the cost of operations of $350 a day, civil commitment will go away after a certain time. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's because it wouldn't take into effect until.
Now, this is for guys sentenced. On or after, so these provisions wouldn't even, these guys would be going to prison before they'd even be considered.
Well, it's even longer than that. You're right, yeah.
Go ahead, Ken. I think you're going
to. Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, just to give a little more information, too, I believe the two groups of offenders that I think are driving some of the fiscal notes are the two groups of offenders who currently have presumed stayed sentences. In other words, they're not presumed to go to prison, and that's second-degree criminal sexual conduct, contact cases with victims under 13. That's currently a presumed stayed sentence at zero history points, and then fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct, which is also a contact as opposed to penetration case involving force or coercion. Those offenses currently generally don't go to prison for the most part, at least at low criminal history scores.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Turner. When you're looking at the way that we're funding these in the out years and the fact that we've got, if we implement anything that modernizes the system and develops path that ultimately will work, you can't do it in there without incurring all of this. Is that right?
Mr. Turner?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, modernizes the system how?
What I'm saying, Madam Chair and Mr. Turner, is that if you're looking at someone in the path there and you change the path from the current system to the intermediate thing, that doesn't offer any incentive for saving any money. In fact, it costs us money, at least by your estimate, as I hear, of 6 years. Was that?
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, this bill's going to cost money on the correction side. It's going to cost quite a bit of money on the correction side. And sex offender program savings won't come down the line until 6 years, but even then it won't show up in a budget. It'll just be guys not being committed and being retained in prison. And so it's not like we're going to get a savings on a fiscal note on this. What we're trying to do is just bend the way the civil commitment process. Actually, we're trying to use it less. Yeah. And the point of this bill, from what I gather, is to pinpoint as accurately as possible within the criminal code the guys we think are going, when they're released from prison, we think are going to be referred for commitment and then committed. That's a difficult thing to do, and this is a start. But from the preliminary analysis, it looks like if you put everybody in prison, of course you're going to save commitment costs, but you're going to have high DOC costs because we're going to be having them, we're going to be holding them in DOC. And roughly half of those guys now are getting probationary sentences. That may be right, it may be wrong, but under this bill, they'd be getting either mandatory life they'd be considered for a life sentence or a mandatory stat max with an indeterminate release. This is a wide net.
Madam Chair and Senator Mr. Turner, how can you resolve that? It strikes me as that we've got a barrier out there that's preventing the Department of Corrections or the Public Safety on there to not be inclined to want to do anything because it cuts into their budgeting process.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, this is a tough nut to crack, and I guess that's why we're having the hearing and why the bill has evolved and why it may continue to evolve. I think everybody wants sexual predators to be controlled. This bill tries to, but we're controlling them at the sex offender program at $312 a day. This bill tries to, it wants to maintain control over a certain universe of offenders, but it wants to maintain control of them at $80 a day at Stillwater. Life is messy. The criminal code does its best to pinpoint these guys, but we're moving in the right direction, I think. But I think that I just wanted to point out to you that this bill right now casts a very wide net.
Madam Chair, first.
Senator.
We're looking at was a bill that passed here. I believe I was the author, establishing intermediate sentencing 7 years ago, or 5 years ago, somewhere in that. And was that implemented in any way? Mm-hmm. And what were the results of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I think under the 2005 law changes, we've had, to date, under 10 guys sentenced to indeterminate life sentences. And I believe that the analysis 5 years ago was about triple that. But that was fairly narrowly drawn because... that one may have been too narrowly drawn, whereas this one is too widely drawn. So maybe we want to get that,
place in the middle.
The Goldilocks solution.
Yeah. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, what I was going to say is this, and I don't know how long you want to, have the conversation, because I think it's very useful, a conversation. I think it's probably more than we can, digest, perhaps, in this session. I don't want to say we can't do something, but obviously the fiscal note, we knew we were casting a wider net. We didn't know, how deep that would go into our pocket. So on the correction side. So there are some things, though, I do want to say that I think, the governor's approach is tempting because it's simple and you just double more than double the sentence for a certain group. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily the best, well-thought-out approach. That I think there's a sense that, there's several factors at work, but there's concern about the treatment, the civil commitment, that side, and treatment, and can we afford that? A lot of us think that's unsustainable in the long run, and it's coming up. I mean, it's already, a very expensive proposition for us. Some people, and I think I'm one of them, wonder about the efficacy of the treatment, and do we really ever see, are we going to see people coming out of Moose Lake, for example? I don't know. So can we go on with that indefinitely? I think not, and I think we ought to start preparing to have a different approach. There's also the idea that some people just should be punished more for these heinous crimes. And that's why the wider net, because it picks up some of those, even at the third and fourth degree, where the victims are young. And, you know, maybe we can't afford to do all of that, but I think this warrants further discussion, and I don't know, I don't want to turn my bill into a study, but I think we ought to be talking about getting, you know, working on this, not officially a study, but getting a group of people who want to talk about this and who have these kinds of concerns that I've just enumerated, which are kind of my concerns, that we continue to work, talk about this and work on this and try to refine it. And maybe we may have to, you know, pull the net in a little bit. I don't know. But we should be looking at other alternatives, I think. So, you know, I like the discussion that went on, for example, in state and local about the review panel. That was helpful. But, of course, that's secondary to your concern here. But so there's been good discussion already of some of these pieces. But now that we see what it means in terms of the budget, we do need to keep looking at it and working on it.
So are you thinking, Senator Scheid, of putting a group of folks together during the interim to see if we can figure out the key to the puzzle?
Madam Chair, I think that that's probably the most prudent approach at this point. You know, if we sat down every day and worked and met till whenever, whenever we're done here, we might be able to make this better and make it work better. But I think that it really warrants more thoughtful consideration than it would be able to get in the pressure cooker we're about to enter.
Mm-hmm. I know that this was, the original bill was a governor's recommendation,
yes,
to just double and then some, one crime, one sentence.
Crimsex 1.
Crimsex 1, okay. And so have you had a good working relationship with the governor's office as you're trying to put this bill together?
Well, Madam Chair, I wouldn't say that it's good or bad. I think that they really prefer just that approach. I mean, you know, I think it's too simple. It's a good soundbite, but we're getting tough on these guys. But there's some other guys that we should also be getting tougher on, I think, and that bill doesn't do it in that basic form. So,
okay. So so basically you have not been having the governor's office or representative as a partner in working on this bill?
Madam Chair, I mean, Mr. Kennedy can speak for himself. I think he's here, but I don't.
Mr. Kennedy, are you here?
Yes.
Would you come up to the table, please? As long as it's you we're talking about, we may as well have you come say hello.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And have you had a chance to have conversations with Senator Scheid and work on some resolution on this?
There were conversations that were had. As previously stated at the Judiciary Committee, there are concerns with this bill in terms of the elimination of civil commitment.
Identify yourself for the tape.
I'm sorry.
To ask you to do that.
Harry Kennedy, I'm the State Sex Offender Policy Coordinator.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Concerns with the elimination of civil commitment. There were concerns expressed about the impact on the victims in that with a review panel, they would have to be reliving the crime that happened to them, coming back and being compelled to testify. So there's concerns about that as well and having to come back every, I believe it's 36 months now.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that point, Mr. Kennedy, under the civil commitment process right now, there is no family participating in that process. but they would under the Senator Scheid's proposal.
Mr. Kennedy?
Right now, the civil correct. Right now, but there is impact statements that are considered in the file of offenders, I believe, in the civil commitment process. But in terms of victims coming to testify, that would be during, if necessary, to possible hearing. But in terms of the review process, no.
Senator Ingraham?
Thank you. And follow up. I know we're getting into some of the policy things here, but the eliminating this process is certainly financial in nature. So maybe Senator Scheid can answer this. When this process goes on with the victim every 36 months, does the perpetrator have an opportunity to be there?
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, page 9 talks about that hearing process, and the fact is that the victim may submit a written or oral statement. Let me see here.
Line 32.
I assume the petitioner, who is the offender, would be able to be there or not, or the person. I don't know how those work. I really don't. I don't know how.
Well, yet another
whether
thing
or not.
To work
I think
out.
The victim would have the opportunity to present a written statement. It does say that. It's clear there. Yeah.
So. All right. Senator Limber, I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Scheid, one of the difficulties of an indeterminate sentencing system is that due to the nature that there's really no end date established in law, the indeterminate sentencing can be expensive, not necessarily on a per-day basis, but on a prolonged basis. And it may be difficult to predict if you had a large contingency of these types of inmates to figure out long-term budgets. And so the states that have rejected indeterminate sentencing are ones that have had that discussion. And I don't know if we've really vetted the long-term aspect of it. We could be triggering a tail effect that may grow consistently as more and more people go in. It would be kind of like, I suppose, when you compare it with the system we have now at $350 a day versus the $80 a day, maybe there's a contrasting difference, a lessening in price. But I think we have to make sure that if we would go the indeterminate route, that we have to make sure that we're thinking not only short-term but long-term in it. And I was just wondering, do you think that does your bill get rid of the civil commitment totally, or do you think we need to have at least that option in our sentencing toolbox for that?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm not an expert on that. This is for people who are sentenced under the terms of this legislation, they would not therefore be eligible for civil commitment, a person who's sentenced here, but under 3B or 4. So I don't think it would do away with it, but I don't know what number of people would be left, to fill that. And your comments and the talk about the indeterminate sentencing and the long-term effect or impact is important, and that's why I'm suggesting we need to explore that and look at
Madam
the consequences.
Chair, just
Senator Foley.
It seems to me that you're trying to cast a net that grabs onto civil commitments, but the real goal here, as I understood what you're doing, is the indeterminate sentencing for sex offenders, and the other, we're going to continue to do civil commitments on people that are in the state institutions, the various people in there are not going to go away. They're just going to be committed for shorter periods of time while they're treated for a mental illness, not for a sex offense.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Scheid, I remember vaguely when Representative Bishop was bringing us to the civil commitment place. And he was trying to avoid a legal challenge that may occur if we kept relying on the criminal or the Department of Corrections in order to keep these offenders in for a longer time.
That's true.
And he also wanted to avoid the double jeopardy question that if they came out of their criminal sentence and then to be grabbed and put into a civil sentence, he was trying to delicately thread a needle so that it wouldn't be challenged as a double jeopardy sentence. And in the time that you've made this bill and have presented it, has anyone gone back and found Dave Bishop in Rochester? It would be interesting to have his comments on it now. I'm sure he's very interested in what we're doing, but it would be interesting to get his comments on what might we do now. And it'd be interesting to have him come and give testimony sometime, because I think he could probably give us a past perspective that may that maybe we have missed in the process and maybe help as we continue to create this dialogue in the future.
Madam Chair, I haven't been looking for Dave, but I would, I guess you could assign me to do that. But,
Well, thank you, Senator Scheid, for updating us on this. And members, if anybody wants to tackle this issue with Senator Scheid over the interim, I know that she's looking for good, thoughtful people who would help figure out what exactly it is that we should do. We will look forward to discussions with you in the future, and thank you for coming and doing this today.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for the time.
Our next bill on the agenda is about expungement, Senate Files 560, Senator Latz. Go ahead whenever you're ready, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill that you have before you is the product of, frankly, many years of work and negotiation over the reforms to the expungement statutes. This has been a labor of Senator Ortman's for many years, and then I took over as chief author of the of a broader expungement reform package. A lot of the players that were involved in this issue, the Council for Crime and Justice, the County Attorneys Association, have been working on reforms. And while they could not reach agreement on some of the broader reforms, they did reach consensus on some more narrowly targeted reforms, specifically to facilitate expungement in cases where cases are resolved either through a diversion program or a stay of adjudication. Currently under statute, there are a very narrow band of cases in which are resolved in the favor of the defendant, which are allowed for expungement automatically under the statute. And when it's a statutory expungement, it means that not only judicial records, but records in all branches of government can be sealed. Expungement no longer means destruction of records. It just means sealing of records. For years, the inherent judicial authority piece of expungement, which defendants who are convicted sometimes go in to try to request from a judge, are granted, but it can only be granted for judicial records because that's the limit of the inherent judicial authority. They can't, for separation of powers reasons, order expungement of records maintained at the BCA, for example, or local police departments. So what this bill does is expand the category of expungements that are entitled to that broader statutory remedy to diversion and stays of adjudication. And the reason that's important is because the existing statute only deals with those cases where there hasn't been a plea of guilty or an admission of fault, because that's basically a definition of resolved in favor of the defendant. Here in diversion cases, many counties require an admission of a fault or even sometimes a plea of some sort. In a stay of adjudication, it always includes a plea of guilty, and the judge holds the plea, doesn't enter the conviction on the condition that the defendant comply with certain requirements. And if they do, then at the end of that period of time, the plea is vacated and the charges are dismissed. So in both of these cases, if they successfully complete it, in the end result is there's no conviction on the record, but it doesn't qualify under the current statute. So the county attorney's office, the Council on Crime and Justice have agreed that under these circumstances, it's appropriate for there to be expungement, most importantly for reasons relating to the ability of people to get a job and the ability of people to get housing. So this is a very, very significant advance for people, and particularly those who may not have an extensive criminal history, which is when they would be eligible for diversion or stay of adjudication and the discretion of the parties involved, and it can make it much easier for them to get jobs and housing. You all have been familiar with the second chance efforts and the reentry programs that we've talked about through the Office of Justice Programs. So the reason that we're here today specifically is because of the fiscal note. Frankly, it was not anticipated. We didn't think that we were going to be dealing with a fiscal note, but it turns out that the BCA has submitted a fiscal note, and that's what we have to struggle with today. The judicial system has not submitted a fiscal note. As far as I'm aware, my guess is they probably would end up with a lot less. They'd have less work to do because of this bill, but those savings are in different silos, and so they don't get reflected in the BCA's budget. But they will have fewer expungement motions. They might have some more expungement orders, but those would just be administrative and can even be agreed upon ahead of time at the time of the plea or diversion. If the prosecutor agrees under this bill, they can agree. Then the expungement will be administratively automatic. But I suspect you'll have fewer ex parte orders to get at sealed records, and you'll have fewer expungement petitions. So it'll help in the judicial side of things, but the BCA, according to their fiscal note, is going to have to deal with perhaps some more expungement orders.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, one of the problems that I see with your scenario is the fact that you are counting on the information regarding convictions and others without any knowledge about how you're going to do that. Tell me once you got a bill or a record, in the process. Sure, the judge can order an expungement and take it out of the court records, but it isn't going to get out of the public domain that sends everybody hollering. Tell me how you expect to accomplish that.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, you've identified one of the information age problems with trying to expunge or seal records that are maintained by the government. The fact is records and information is out there. As long as the records are open, they can get distributed well beyond government, and people in society are going to have to deal with that. We can here right now only deal with the existence and future access to existing government records, and that's what I'm attempting to deal with right now. I do have Mark Hazy with me who could perhaps illuminate that if you'd like to go further into that question.
And members, let's remember we're the finance division, not the policy division. We had discussions in Senator Moore's committee about this, and so let's keep the policy pieces of it to a very small part of our discussion today, because I know we've got two more bills. Mr. Hazy, quickly.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Mark Hazy. I'm with the Council on Crime and Justice. Just, Madam Chair and Senator Foley, just quickly, that question always comes out. Yes, we're just stealing government records with an expungement. What about the private data collectors? I would, agree mostly with Senator Latz that it's imperfect. However, a lot of the major reputable data collectors do follow the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, and once the record comes off the government source, then it comes off of their record. Yes, it may still show up somewhere. We have people that we assist with expungement. That expungement does help them. We advise them they have to be careful about where it shows up. And some employers actually look at expungement as sort of a type of certificate of rehabilitation, where if somebody wanted to apply for a job and say, yes, I have this old record, but the court has given me an expungement, some of them will see that. Either the policy says they can hire somebody with a sealed record, even if they know about it, or they will appreciate that the person has gone through the steps in that. And it's also sort of a step forward, and I think the legislature looking at, there's a lot that needs to be done in this area, and this is at least one step forward to give a remedy for some people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, there is other legislation also pending that would deal with data.
That's right.
Collectors.
Mr. Turner, will you give us a tour of the fiscal note?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. Page 2 of the fiscal note explains the BCA's rationale. They say that reviewing petitions for expungement is labor-intensive. Then they list their costs. The cost table is on page 3. Personnel with equipment first year would be $49,000. With tails, $46,000 the second year because the equipment's already bought, but there would be some training involved. And then continuing tails of $31,600 thereafter to implement this bill.
Okay, thank you. Senator Latz, I see you have an A-10 amendment. Do you want to, and members, we have it in our packets, I believe.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A-10 amendment.
You can't.
Actually, I can. I'm on the division.
You are a member of this committee.
Yes.
I forgot. Gosh, I'm sorry.
Friday.
It's been a long day already, and it's only noon. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry I haven't been here. We've got a claims committee meeting going on right now.
All right. So it's pretty straightforward, members. It says that the Department of Public Safety shall absorb any costs incurred as a result of this act within its existing budget. I assume the department might want to weigh in on this amendment. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, I've got some thoughts on the fiscal note itself, too, at the appropriate time.
All right. Commissioner Campion or somebody from the Department of Public Safety, if you'd want to weigh in on this amendment? All right. While they're talking back there, is there any discussion in the committee on this amendment? Oh. Senator Ingerbretson.
I'm sorry, not on the amendment, just the bill itself.
Here he comes. Welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, Michael Campion, the Commissioner of Public Safety. Senator, how are you?
I'm fine.
We understand the intent of the bill. We understand there's a fiscal note of about $97,000. We will do the best we can to accommodate it.
Okay. That's straightforward. Okay. On any other discussion on the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Commissioner, I want to ask the Commissioner one more question. In light of our budgets not being completely finalized, I'm curious that you could absorb this $96,000 cost when you may not know exactly what the budget is in your budget at the end of this session.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, It's a very fair analysis. I think I said we would do the best we can. I mean, that's certainly a consideration, but.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer?
If we make this law, then it will fall in, and it won't be just to the best of your ability. You will have to do it. So I would be more comforted if I knew exactly if you could do it.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, my experience with these kinds of matters is that certainly it will be done. It will be done in a slower manner than we would probably like, and other processes will slow down in those areas. Specifically to what extent, I wouldn't be able to tell you, but it's not that we wouldn't be able to accomplish what this bill intends to do. We just may not be able to do it in as timely a manner as everybody in the world would like.
The reason I ask that is, you know,
Senator Limmer.
The governor proposed his budget for public safety, and we're in discussion with this budget. They're quite a bit different, so, and both of them take a serious bite out of your budget, and so I just wanted to make sure.
Thank you for consideration, Senator.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. All right, on the A-10 amendment, all in favor of adopting the A-10 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, on the bill as amended, any further discussion? Senator Ingebretson.
My question, Madam Chair, Senator Letts, is on the judiciary. Senator Foley, I and Senator Limmer, I guess several of us sit on that committee. And it appears that the courts are certainly going to be actually spending some more time on it. And you said there was no fiscal note on that? Or, I mean, is it going to be something that's going to be very time-consuming to the courts, more so than now?
Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, a lot of what is now happening by petition and filing and calendars of hearings on expungement motions will happen automatically and administratively instead. I mean, I can't speak to why there was no specific fiscal note in front of you in terms of the process, but that would be my expectation in terms of how the judiciary might respond. I think Mr. Hazy can have some additional information for you.
So you're saying that it would actually save the courts money in the long run?
Madam Chair, I think that it will, and not only because of fewer expungement motions, but because under the current law, if law enforcement or the corrections department, probation, prosecutors want access to sealed records, expunged records, for purposes of determining if there were any changes to sentencing or background or history, or if there are new charges to be brought, whether they should be aggravated or enhanced in some way. Right now they have to go in and get ex parte orders from a judge to authorize the access to the expunged record. In the bill that you have before you, they will have automatic access electronically to those expunged records. In fact, that's a fair chunk of the fiscal note from the BCA is making the computer changes, the programming changes, to allow that easy electronic access by all of those bodies. But that should relieve some of the court's burden.
Okay. Any further discussion on Senate File 560 as amended?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ma.
Madam Chair, I wonder if Senator Limmer will yield.
Senator Limmer shakes his head, yes.
Senator Limmer, I just wonder if you're going to have a delete everything amendment on the floor to also strip the expungement sections from this bill.
Madam Chair, I might just have a, quiet little discussion with the author. Maybe we can work out a few bumps and bruises on the bill. That's the way I usually like to work.
Yeah, except if they're my bills, Senator.
There's an exception.
We'll include Senator Ortman in that discussion.
Okay, let's vote.
Senator Berglund. Can I just ask what we're voting on?
Sure, we're voting on Senator Latz's expungement provisions, Senate File 560.
And can I just ask one question?
Sure.
Is there a little pot of money someplace to pay for it?
The Commissioner of Public Safety said that they would absorb the cost.
Okay.
And do the best that they could do in the time they had available. Okay. On Senator Latz's motion, that Senate File 560 be recommended to pass, and I think it goes to the floor from here. Is that right? No, it has to go to Big Finance. Sorry. On that motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Moi.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members, thank you so very much for giving me the time. And Madam Chair, I'm happy to report that according to my conversation with my children's teachers this morning, they're both doing fine.
Excellent.
I had parent-teacher conferences this morning, so I apologize for being late. Madam Chair, I wonder if we could take up Senate File 2493 first.
I think we could. Go right ahead whenever you're ready.
Members, Senate File 2493 is a bill that came to me from our state's Attorney General's office. I believe that you have a handout in your packets showing a bunch of identity theft devices that, frankly, I just have to tell you that once I saw these photos, I think I've decided that I'm going to go cash base. In what I do. But the Senate File 2493 is an attempt to address an identity theft technology that has been very successfully employed in the state of Minnesota. And if you look at the handout in front of you, the middle photograph shows you scale, the size of this device compared to a cigarette lighter, so you know how compact this is. And it's, if somebody has this device in the palm of their hands, whenever you go to a restaurant or go to a place where you're using your debit cards or your credit cards, somebody, before they do your transaction, could very easily just swipe the information from your debit card or credit card with this teeny tiny device. The top number shows you an ATM machine. It's a plate that gets put on the exterior of the ATM machine because the scanner for the information from your bank is inside the machine. But this little device gets put right over your ATM machines, and when you put in your card, it will also scan and steal your information. Likewise, the device on the bottom, it has been put on those red boxes where people go and get $1 movies at Cub Foods or McDonald's or any of these places. People don't think about it. When I go, I don't look at it. But these devices have been very successfully employed in this state to steal people's identity. And so what we're doing in this bill, Madam Chair and members, is to make it a crime to not only use the device here to steal people's personal information, but then to also use another device to take that information and then re-encode it onto another document, another credit card, another debit card, with perhaps a different photograph or a different type of PIN number. And so we're trying to regulate both the device to steal the information and the device to reinstate or re-encode that information onto people's credit cards or debit cards. The reason why the bill is before you today is because I believe we create a felony with the language that's in the bill as the sanction and the consequence. So, I'm open to discussion with the members. I have to apologize. I've not had a chance to see the fiscal note. So I would very much appreciate a input and discussion from the members as to the fiscal impact.
Let's have Mr. Turner walk us through the fiscal note. It has a bunch of zeros or blank spaces.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You're lucky.
Members.
Mr. Turner.
You'll turn to page 5 in the fiscal note. That gives the analysis. The courts or the sentencing guidelines assumes that there will be 20 new felony cases a year under this provision. The courts have estimated that caseload equals approximately 3% of a judge unit, which comes to about $11,000. So they say that there's a minimal impact. They're not going to quantify it. However, they do write on page 5, they write, while this individual bill will not result in significant costs for the judicial branch, the combination of work increases with staff reductions as a result of our budget cuts will delay the timely completion of judicial work, including the disposition of cases. And I think that, you know, that should at least be stated on record, that as we ask the court to do more and as we cut their budget, it should at least be recognized.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none.
Madam Chair, if the members are willing to send this forward despite that information being on the record and the minimal impact on the floor, I'd like to move that Senate File 2493 be recommended to pass and be referred to the full Committee on Finance.
Any discussion? Seeing none. On Senator Waugh's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion prevails. And then the last bill of the day, Senate File 2493. Senator, nope, that's not right. 2725.
Thank Senator you, Madam Ma. Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. We're here to address Senate File 2725. I just want to take a moment of your time, Madam Chair. I know that we're here to discuss the cost implications, and I do have an amendment that perhaps will help to deal with some of that, and we can hear from the department and the people who are concerned about it. So in between the state and local government committee and this committee, we have taken a hard look at some of the provisions that are going to invoke some cost impacts, and at a minimum, we've tried to address that, and there's an amendment to do that. But, Madam Chair, members, there's been a lot of discussion on this bill since it left the Senate Judiciary Policy Committee. And I guess for the record, I just want to take this opportunity to say that I brought this bill to the Senate not because I have any intention to be perverse or to be reckless or a desire to be the head lobbyist for gangs. I'm a Minnesotan, and I'm a proud St. Paulite. I am proud to chair a committee that cares about public policy in this state, and in particular criminal justice policy. I consider myself a friend and advocate for law enforcement, and I think my record proves time and again that I have done as much as I can to support the work of law enforcement. I also believe that it is really important for public policy to catch up to technology, and I definitely believe that smart public safety tools can be found and smart public safety technology and techniques can be employed, and good public safety can be achieved without trampling on the privacy and civil rights of residents and citizens of this state. And so, Madam Chair, members, it is in this spirit that I brought this bill forth to the Senate, and it is in this spirit that I am proud to be in this committee today. Madam Chair, members, I think that you all have a very good idea of what this bill deals with. There are several sections to the bill. The first part of the bill wraps up the work that we've been doing in this committee, along with the policy committee and the other body, and the corresponding committees and the other body during the interim to try to wrap up the consequences of the Metro Gang Strike Force. The first part of this bill does that, to try to restructure and to find some way to reorganize and restructure how we can be responsive to the issues that were brought forth by the Metro Gang Strike Force issues this summer. So the first part of the bill is an attempt to do that. I think that in that work there's some cost implications to that, and so I'm hoping to be able to address that in an amendment that will come shortly. Two other parts of the bill deal, the second half of the bill deals with data. And two parts of the bill, one part dealing with cybers and the other part dealing with traveling data. I don't believe that there are any cost implications in that. The policy committee has had a discussion on that, and we have sent that forth. I don't believe there are any cost implications for that. But the third piece of the data issue addresses an issue that has been raised consistently that does affect privacy concerns and civil rights concerns. And in the Judiciary Policy Committee, I amended the language as introduced in the bill to repeal immediately the gang net system and other local government databases that are similar to Ramsey County's the gang pointed file system and other similar databases to the Ramsey County Gang Net system. And so I believe that there may be cost implications involved in those two sections. As this bill has moved through the various committees, Madam Chair and members, a number of amendments have been put on the bill to try to address some of the concerns raised by law enforcement. And so, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to offer the A16 amendment for your consideration.
Members, that's in your packet, I believe. Would you walk us through this amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. You may recall that in the bill, as it left the Senate Judiciary Policy Committee, there was an absolute repeal of the gang pointer file system that is currently being maintained by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and an absolute prohibition of local law enforcement agencies from enacting gang net type profiling databases. In state and local government, I put a delayed enactment date on those two repealer sections because law enforcement said that an immediate repeal would create transition issues. And so we put a delayed enactment date. In the meantime, there's been ongoing conversations with the law enforcement community. So the A16 amendment is an amendment to deal both with the cost pieces, but there are some policy language in here. And if the committee would be willing to indulge, I would rather be able to have a discussion about it in this committee than give us an opportunity to do some other work if we need to.
And so the first, Senator Moore, I think that's appropriate for this committee. I know that state and local said that some of the issues that you were bringing to that committee weren't really anything they knew anything about and deferred to our committee. And so I think that's appropriate that we do that here. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 1 of the bill is a different way of addressing the prohibition on the local law enforcement profiling databases. Instead of an absolute prohibition, the language in the attempt to rework with the system of what's in current law, it permits local law enforcement agencies to keep their own databases, and it allows them, as it is under current law, to be able to share specific file information with one another. Law enforcement has indicated that without the ability to be able to communicate with each other on specific individuals or files, that would really prohibit their ability to do work. And so here's comfort language to say that local law enforcement agencies can maintain their own databases, and they could talk to each other on a per-file basis. And what the effect of this is, Madam Chair and members, is to prevent the gangnet type databases that is the co-mingling and the wholesale dumping of profiling data into a long-term database that doesn't have very much oversight to govern who's in those databases. I have to be honest with you that the communities who have been most affected by these profiling databases are not pleased with my taking this position. I like my original position of the absolute prohibition, and the communities like my original position. They may even testify that they don't no longer like what I'm doing here, and they absolutely will be appropriate in doing that. But out of consideration for law enforcement, who said that they're willing to continue to work with me to put in place the appropriate oversight, I am willing to work with law enforcement to continue to equip them at each local agency to have the ability to keep these databases. I just don't want the commingling of this in a larger database. So Section 1 of the bill is an attempt to do that. The delayed enactment date is still in there because I believe that it's fair to give law enforcement some transition time to move in this direction. Lines 1.15 to line 1.29 of the bill, Madam Chair, I believe, and maybe Ms. Pontius can help me, is an attempt to address some language changes that we're taking out of the bill, one of which is to delete out the section on reporting of forfeiture, because we have another forfeiture bill and we're dealing with forfeiture language in that bill. So I wonder if Mr. Backus or Ms. Pontius could confirm that.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, that's correct. On line 1.28, that's where you delete section 6, which is the forfeiture reporting requirement. The lines in between that, then, 1.15 to 1.27, that deletes a requirement in the bill for the new Violent Crime Oversight Council, where multi-jurisdiction entities under the new Oversight Council have to be subject to operational and financial audits conducted by outside independent agencies. So that deletes that as well.
So you're deleting the audit? Okay. All right. Continue on, please.
Madam Chair and members, Section 9 of the amendment, which is the last section of the bill, is an attempt to clean up language of the work group. We don't change the structure. We don't change the different requirements that the state and local government work group requires of a work group, but we do change a little bit. Instead of I think the unrealistic expectation that there would be a consensus for the group to report back, we see this as truly a work group that will report back the different options or the different strands of conversations that have been outlined, and then leave it to the legislature to debate which is the best way to move forward and how we deal with criminal databases, criminal intelligence databases, investigative databases, and law enforcement databases in this state. And so this work group, which was suggested, I put this into the bill at the request of the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association to make sure that we really truly do a work group to look at this, to also put it in the bill to send the signal that the delayed enactment date truly is a real delayed enactment, because it is our hope that this work group will come back with some recommendations on how we can better deal with databases. And then the suggested language in terms of having the work group report back without requiring a consensus recommendation also came from law enforcement and the BCA to try to address the potential cost if we are requiring them to put together a really hefty recommendation that's going to take a lot of time to write. Instead, we're asking them to come back with an executive summary and to actually come to committee to talk to us about the work that they're doing.
And we can put it on the record that we don't really want a pretty brochure. We don't want
we don't want
fancy
color, yes.
Report. It can be in black and white. We don't need color printing. We just want substance. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moi, I'm a little concerned about the makeup of the group. It's called a work group of stakeholders and interested parties. And usually when we direct the creation of any type of group or a commission, we usually try to create a balance of interested parties, trying to recognize the concerns of a variety of different groups. This doesn't have a total number. It doesn't reflect balance. Are we missing anyone? Could someone be missed? How would an interested party even know there is a group like this? I guess those are just some of the questions I have. I guess I would be more comfortable if we had a specific number and that we would be balancing the number with the interested parties that perhaps have already shown an interest in it. And that way you're not... I mean, this could be three people or it could be 300 people. And I'm just concerned that we should have some balance in this type of work group.
Senator Moi.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to answer. And then if the commissioner has a response specific to this, I'm certainly willing for him to respond. Senator Limmer, you know that this area is a very narrow area of law. As a member of the Data Practice Subcommittee, I think you and I both know who all the players are. who have the expertise and the interest in this. While it's narrow and there may be a small number of people who have the expertise on this, it is an issue of tremendous importance to the future of this state. My intention in doing this is not to bar participation, but to create a context and a circumstance where we get the people who are the experts who are truly interested in this at the table to have the conversation. And I think without naming them in this bill, you and I already know who those people are going to be. And I think that the BCA knows that too. These meetings are going to be open to the public. They're going to be transparent. Because that's the only way that it can be done. And so we could try to craft and name groups and individuals. But we will add two more pages, I think, to this list. And I just thought that it would lead to a much productive outcome if we were able to let those stakeholders who are already engaged in this conversation continue the work that they're doing, but making it open to other interested parties who want to participate. And it will be up to the director of IPED to make a determination. But it could be 300 people. Then so be it. Let 300 people be engaged in the conversation. But if only 3 people show up, but they're the experts and the people who care about this, then so be it. Those 3 people will help to shape the conversation.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Lima.
If there was a dispute, let's say in the direction of where this group will make its recommendations, does that mean that one side calls 300 people to all vote on it in the room? Or does the group have, it has its purpose, it has its areas of consideration that's been outlined, but we don't invite 300 extra people into the Senate to vote on a recommendation that we're going to give to government. We're elected. In this case, we're sanctioning the creation of a work group. And we're hoping they give us some direction. I think that's good. I think we do need direction. But to have just an open-ended opportunity, I don't know where the true representation would come. I'm trying to help at the end product. Is it going to raise more questions than not? And I just don't want to get to that point at the end of the trail.
Madam Chair, Senator Lemmer, I understand exactly where you're coming from. Too often we've sat in this room to hear reports and recommendations from groups where it's an 18-18 split or a 19-18 split with a majority opinion and a minority opinion. That's why this amended language is going to go on the bill to make sure that we are not artificially forcing people to take a split position because this is a contentious issue. And that it is important for all the different options and strands of conversation to come back to the legislature. It is not up to a work group in this policy area to recommend to us the direction we should go. But the purpose of the work group is to do the work, lay out the options, and then bring it back to this body so that we make the decision explicitly and upfront on where the public policy should be for this state. And so the language in this amendment doesn't say that you come back with a recommendation, but you come back and report to us on the work of the work group as to the strands of conversation that you will be having in this work group.
Okay, well, Madam Chair.
Senator Lima.
Madam Chair, then how do we explain lines 2, 4, and 5 where it says they're going to send this document to us summarizing the work group's meetings, outline proposed legislative changes to implement recommendations on where there is agreement? So they are charged with making legislative recommendations to us. And you just said that they're not charged with making recommendations.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, they could come to us with 150 legislative recommendations that are all contradictory to each other. But they've done the work and they've done the research. They lay out the recommendation to say if you go down path A, this would be what the language would look like, and these are the consequences. If you go down path B, this is what it would look like, and this would be the consequence. If you go down path C, And so that's the task of the work group, is to do the thoughtful work, bringing together all the experts, and bring those options to us. And we then get to introduce the bills and get to have the debate.
Senator Moore, the last step was in state and local government. Did they look at this work group language or something similar?
Madam Chair, members, I have talked to Senator Rest about this, and I'll tell you, I absolutely can't guarantee you what answer she gave me, but I know I talked to her about it. And given how we've been on the floor, you understand exactly. So I'd be glad to chat with her again.
That'd be great. Thank you. Senator Berglund. Yeah.
Madam Chair and Senator Moore, what does your amendment do to the fiscal note?
Madam Chair and members, I'm interested in knowing that, too, because this amendment was prepared in response to the fiscal note. So I would be interested in hearing from Mr. Turner, if he knows. If not, then from the different agencies who showed up in the fiscal note. I guess I want to let the people who showed up here respond to that, whether or not the amendment helps.
Okay, well, then if they could please do that, that would be my request.
Okay. Do you want to do that now?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members. There are two sections that have fiscal implications. Section 3, the contract for audit of multi-jurisdictional entities, or the VSETs. And DPS estimates that the audits would cost $95,000. In the fiscal note itself, it said that would come out of existing grants. However, the amendment takes away the audit requirement. So that's taken care of. And then in Section 10, DPS cites $39,000 in staff support or administrative support for the working group. And I think that the amendment scales back the requirements of DPS. And Mr. Backus has discussed this with DPS, and he may want to comment on their reaction.
Madam Chair and members, the current work group language in the amendment was essentially suggested by DPS, so it's been tweaked to reflect their concerns, but they can speak to that if they want to.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the amendment eliminates.
Start with your name and name again, please. I'm sorry.
Michael
it's
Campion,
just for the
Madam
record.
Chair, I apologize. Senator Berglund, the amendment eliminates the fiscal note.
Okay. Thank you.
Wow. Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Senator, I'm glad you came with the amendment. One of the things that made it very clear here now, at least coming from the first go-around, your first bill, initial bill, it said must not administer computerized gang investigative to may maintain. I was wondering, frankly, that really caught my eye as to what we were doing with a system that we have spent a lot of money on in Minnesota obtaining over the last years. And I come from the area where this actually originated from some years back of putting together a system to help fight gang activity not only in the metro but also suburbs and statewide. And I was somewhat concerned about the spending of the dollars on that system, and all of a sudden that doesn't work anymore. And one of the questions I'm very concerned about that, but the question I have, maybe this should be directed to the commissioner, is where are we with cyber now? I mean, that was a very large investment, if I remember right. Where is the cyber system now, percentage-wise?
Madam Chair, Senator Engelbertson, I don't know if my numbers are accurate, but there's some 100-plus local law enforcement agencies that are connected and contribute to cybers. It's more complicated than what I think we need to get into at this hearing, but it's not as simple a process as hooking up another agency. Their records management system must comply and there needs to be adapters. And my understanding is that contacts have been made, discussions have ensued, and a timetable has been agreed upon or reached in terms of the major agencies. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Hennepin, and Ramsey are in various stages of it. I can't say that they're going to be hooked up in the next month or two, but once they make some accommodations through their vendors that provide the records management system, then it affords them the opportunity to get hooked up to cybers. But as time goes on, as month after month, more and more agencies continue to be connected to cybers and contribute and retrieve information out of that system.
Well, Senator Moore, I know that this is a substantial amendment, and I if we could have a little testimony on the amendment before we adopt it, I think that that would be appropriate. Members, would be okay. Chief Harrington?
Madam Chair, John Harrington, City of St. Paul, Chief of Police. I'm coming here today to testify on behalf of this bill. I've had numerous conversations with Senator Ma about this bill. I have been a gang investigator dating back to my days as a sergeant, working in the St. Paul Police Department, have been recognized as a gang expert in court, and have worked on both the gang strike force and on working on St. Paul's own gang intervention project, which seeks to prevent, intervene, and enforce the law against gangs. The reason I came to support this bill is because I really believe that good gang intervention, good law enforcement is based on community support. And the GangNet program has been so closely connected to the gang strike force that it has lost community support. You can't have good law enforcement if you don't have the community backing you. And my constituents in St. Paul have said over and over again since the very public demise of the gang strike force that that raised great concerns about the legitimacy of the activities of that organization. Not all of it. I can tell you that there were many very good arrests and very, very good investigations that came out of that. But I believe that this particular program is tainted by that reputation. I am very pleased to see both the work group, which would bring together experts that would bring us to a point where an officer in Duluth meeting a St. Paul gangster will have the information necessary so that they can be both safe and so that investigations can go forward. I think there is a definite need for a statewide program to do that, and I believe that the Department of Public Safety and BCA is the right place to house that. This bill does not preclude the St. Paul Police Department gang unit from continuing its work to prevent gangs, a la SAGA, where we've gotten 23 young gang members jobs and have kept them out of trouble for a year. That couldn't have been done if we hadn't had our local database. It also doesn't preclude us from going after gangsters that have shot and killed people, as in the case of the triple homicide most recently. We went federal indictment on that. So I am very supportive of the intent behind this bill. I believe that this is a work in progress, obviously. It's still in informative stages, but I'm very happy to be able to say that we support this.
Thank you very much. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, could you tell me what's broken about the data that's in the system right now? What's broken?
Chief Arrington.
I know there was problems with the gang strike force, but what's broken with the data system?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen. The thing that I am most concerned about in this current system is the lack of a regular audit and a regular process for culling out really old data and really old contacts in the system. My understanding of the system is that once you're in the system, you could remain in that system for years and years and years despite having had no further contacts. There are people that I probably may have had in a car stop back when I was a sergeant that went into the system who are now mothers and fathers and businessmen and very successful and have had no contact with the gangs in years and years. And there needs to be a way to audit and clear that system out periodically to make sure that the data in that system is still accurate and timely and correct.
Thank you. Commissioner, do you have remarks at this time?
Not at this time, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Campion, your mention on the last line of the amendment, the Department of Public Safety shall provide administrative support. Do you agree with the fiscal analysis that this is not going to cost your agency any new money?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes.
Okay. And has there been any discussion, or is there anyone from the Department of Administration that could give comment about this request for this responsibility?
There seems to be. Welcome to our committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Lori Barkopensky. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division. And Senator Limmer, to your question, The department has put a $6,000 fiscal note on this, but what we have described is almost all of this work would be work, given that we are a small field, that we would already have been participating in and following these discussions. And the fiscal note and the amendment certainly even reduces our costs even more. We had been prepared to absorb those costs, given that we would want to be a part of this discussion.
All right.
Boy, everybody's working really well together here.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I have to put on the record that when I called Ms. Byer-Krupinski and begged her to chair this work group, the way I persuaded her was to say, if somebody else chairs it, do you still have to show up for the meetings? And she said, yep. And so I said, well, then why don't you just chair it? So she would still have to show up anyways.
Well, good for you, and thank you for agreeing to do that. I think this work group can give us some valuable information. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to talk to us about the A16 amendment before we vote on whether to adopt it? Mr. Neumeister, is that your arm way back there?
Yes,
it is. Welcome back to our committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I just saw the amendment just a few moments ago. Some of the questions I just asked, I see that there's the sunset is on August 1st, 2011, for this new Section 1.
Mr. Neumeister, it's not a sunset, it's an effective date.
Pardon me, the sunset, where it takes effective. You
effective
are correct, ma'am, and I apologize. It's just been driving for the last 8 hours. And but the questions I have is, it's not clear to me what would the criteria be used for the individuals who are comprised of data on individuals who are gang members. Would that be the current criteria? Or if you take a look at the broader bill and the bigger bill, it says there's going to be new criteria, possibly be revised by the Crime and Violent Committee, or whatever the new name of that group is now. The second concern I have is, or may be engaged in criminal gang activity. Again, what is the criteria? What is the standard that is being used for these people to be placed in those databases? The other thing that, in terms of the work group, and Madam Chair and members of the committee, in my decades on doing a lot of this type stuff, it's very complex, it's very hardworking, takes a commitment from all people to go with, you know, to go to these meetings and all that. And one of the things I have some concerns about in terms of the work group is that I think it's important to articulate those things where there is agreement, but those things that are not. So the legislature very much knows. And knowing about this issue as well as I do, there will probably be some disagreements and there will be some agreements, particularly when it comes to issues of civil liberties. And there's options. So I think it's very important to when this report comes back, to outline what the options are for you as policymakers too. Because a number of states have done a lot of things in this, all the way to where high accountability, high standards for civil liberties and probable cause and all that when you collect data, all the way to some states that are on one end. So I think that's very important for you to do. And that's about it for what the comments, at least with the amendment I have seen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
As our resident citizen data privacy person, once more, we thank you for your input. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Senator Moi, any comments on anything so far from anybody you've heard from?
None, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A16 amendment.
Okay. So anybody else? Professor. Okay. Welcome back to our committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In looking at the...
If you'd identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Nakima Levy-Pounds. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law and the director of the Community Justice Project, which is a civil rights legal clinic.
And your testimony will be on the A16 amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
I am raising one question in particular about the A16 amendment. Section 1, subdivision 30, point number 2, investigative data obtained from other law enforcement agencies on an individual record inquiry basis. My question has to do with what standards will be in place to ensure accuracy of those records that are being shared, because this goes back to the heart of the issue that this whole thing has been about. oversight, accountability, and transparency. And the maintenance of both the gang pornophile as well as the GangNet database systems by the Metro Gang Strike Force and the role that it played in administering data. As many of you know, we undertook an independent review of GangNet and of gang pornophile. One of the things that we found was that with regard to GangNet, there was no statute or local ordinance that authorized its existence, nor was there anything that laid out the standards for the operations and procedures of GangNet in any statute or local ordinance. And so as a result, the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office was able to maintain a database that had data on over 16,000 individuals. And in looking at Andy Luger's report, we see a lot of parallels in terms of the concerns that are raised when a law enforcement entity is not, there's not proper oversight and accountability and transparency in terms of the infringement on individual liberties and civil rights and privacy interests. So in looking at Mr. Luger's report on page 26, he talked about the issues with photographs that they uncovered when they were investigating the Metro Gang Strike Force. As you may know, with regard to these databases, photographs are used as one of the 10-point criteria for identifying whether a person is considered to be in a gang. And so in looking at his report, Andy Luger says, similarly, we found a great deal of evidence to suggest that Strike Force officers conducting saturation detail stops will routinely take pictures of individuals they encountered, including photographs with individuals holding Metro Gang Strike Force identifying information. These included pictures of children. We're troubled by this practice of requiring innocent people to be photographed as though they had engaged in illegal conduct. It is our understanding that these photographs were maintained at the Strike Force offices. And so the reason that this is important is when you look at the 10-point criteria that's being used by both those who operate GangNet and the gang pornophile, one criteria has to do with photographs being used to document gang members. And so here we see a parallel in terms of some of the corruption that occurred and the role that it could play in the data that is already being maintained. Now, when I look at page 27 of Mr. Luger's report, he talks about potential abuse of the NCIC database. And he says that the Strike Force had access to the Criminal Justice Information System database, and through it, the records of the National Criminal Information Center database, which is NCIC. This is a highly regulated database that the FBI provides to law enforcement agencies for use in the investigation of criminal conduct. Law enforcement agencies receive training and strict instruction that the database is to be used for law enforcement purposes only. The panel heard from a number of witnesses who alleged that the NCIC system was accessed by Strike Force employees for non-governmental purposes. If true, this is a direct violation of the terms of use of the NCIC databases. Andy Luger goes on later, and he talks about case files on page 27. The case files that the Metro Gang Strike Force held contain false documents, and it's difficult to know whether items that are not in the evidence room were actually destroyed. So again, this goes back to the heart of accountability, transparency, and oversight, and making sure that governmental bodies are making decisions that protect the privacy of individuals, balancing, obviously, public safety needs. And so if I'm looking at the A16 Amendment, and it just generally says investigative data obtained from other law enforcement agencies can be collected by other agencies without any standards, oversight, accountability, and transparency, are we setting up a loophole that opens up the authority for other GangNet systems to be in operation across the state of Minnesota?
Okay.
So that's something that I think needs to be raised here today, because you have a number of people from the community who have complained about the infringement of their rights by those who are supposed to be protecting their rights.
Thank you. Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, she's right.
She is. And I know that we have another stop in big finance and then on the floor, and I believe that there will be opportunities to further refine this. And I'm sure that Senator Moy would appreciate your advice on that as she goes forward. Thank you so much.
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that testimony. We've gotten a little bit off of finance here, I think, but being we did, let's get something clear in my mind. Now, this Metro Gang Strike Force thing has been an issue for some time, and you made some corruption allegations, and that's not the first time I've heard that. So where is that at right now? Are there some officers that are being looked at? I guess I'm going to throw the question out, being it was talked about. Are some officers being looked at? The reason I ask that question is when we start looking at whole new systems here and spending lots of state dollars and local dollars on new systems, are we overreacting because of one or two bad apples here? I want to be cautious and make sure that we're not doing that. If those bad apples are being taken out of the basket, are they being dealt with, and is that going to resolve the problem? If it does, I mean, that needs to happen instead of casting the whole state into that same thing.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I believe the FBI is now investigating and where they are with that investigation. Right. I guess we'll find out when they're ready to tell us.
And thank you for that, Madam Chair. And that's probably a good reason why we slow down a little bit and move with this, and Senator Moore is doing that instead of moving ahead. I still have a question on the bill, but I'll wait till the amendment.
Okay. On the amendment, Senator Foley?
Just a comment on something else. I have a constituent here, Mr. Parker, who I'd like to have afford the opportunity to testify in this.
Last I heard, I think. Oh, yes. Yeah, we will do that. Any other questions for Professor Levy-Pounds? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, in regard to the language in the amendment, is investigative data, does that include just random pictures that people might have taken?
May I respond,
Professor?
According to our research, all of the data that's been collected by law enforcement in these gang databases is considered to be investigative data. And so what you had happen with regard to the GangNet database system, for example, which is administered by Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, used by 96 agencies across the state, and held over 16,000 names in it before we got involved, for that particular database, data was held for 10 years that was really just sitting there, again, without proper oversight, accountability, or transparency. And given that it is considered to be investigative data, it's also considered to be confidential, which means that neither a person whose data is in the system or the parent of a child under 14 had any knowledge or information pertaining to their data being held in the GangNet system. And in answer to your question, Senator, with regard to whether or not a couple of bad apples can spoil the whole bunch, well, I believe that that is the case with regard to these databases. And as you heard from the chief, the conduct of the Metro Gang Strike Force certainly has seemed to have tainted the GangNet database system because they made documenting so-called gang members one of their highest priorities. And in fact, in their 2008 report, they talked about that and how they increased the number of gang members that they documented in that in 2007 by 13%. And so when you think about the fact that they were out documenting people and given the low threshold for entry into the GangNet database system, because you only need to meet one of 10-point criteria. So one of the 10-point criteria is that you are known to associate with known gang members. And so in my last testimony before the previous Senate committee, I gave the illustration that I could end up in the GangNet database system because I attend church on the east side of St. Paul. If I'm standing outside after church speaking to young men who have been in a gang or are leaving the gang life and officers see me, they can then document me as a gang member, and I could end up in the GangNet database system, which then leads to issues of collateral consequences, et cetera. So, yes, there has been a taint related to the conduct of the Metro Gang Strike Force, and when you couple that with the lack of accountability, transparency, and oversight, we need to dig deeper and resolve this situation as soon as possible. It was outside the purview of what Andy Luger was asked to do, which is part of why our office got involved and our law students spent hundreds of hours researching this information and putting our own report together, which was released in December of 2009.
Okay. Thank you, Professor.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
My question is for Senator Moore. don't you think that this information should be a little bit more narrow in scope that gets to be transferred? I mean, I can understand if a police investigation is taking place in regard to an actual crime that has happened, that they would want to be able to transfer that information, especially if there's been a crime that's been committed in another jurisdiction that might relate to that individual. Mm-hmm. But this seems like it isn't very narrow at all in terms of, you know, there's some place between, you know, continuing the practice that has gone on in the past and allowing the transfer of information that would be relevant to an investigation of a crime.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, that has been the struggle that I have been going through, not about which, but to strike that balance. And so this language may be, may not quite capture it yet, but poor Ms. Pontius has done so many different iterations to try to capture exactly to strike exactly the balance that you've articulated. And, you know, if this doesn't do it, Ms. Pontius and I would really appreciate a different set of eyes to help or a different set of pens to help us capture that. But that's exactly what we're trying to get at with this language. And we've asked law enforcement to help. They know what we're trying to get to. We know what we're trying to get to. We don't know if the language quite does that yet. And so...
Well, Madam Chair...
Senator Berglund.
Senator, I understand full well when you're working on a difficult issue sometimes how hard it is, but I would hope that we would be able to do better than this by the time this gets to the full Finance Committee. This is the first committee I've been on that this bill has appeared, and I just have to tell you I feel uncomfortable.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Professor. Have Melvin Carter Sr. and Mr. Parker come up, and then I think it's time to move to a vote. Mr. Parker?
Thank you, Senator. Senator Higgins.
Go ahead, Mr.
Carter. My name is Melvin Carter Jr., actually. Melvin Carter Sr., my father lives over on University and Fairview, and he's doing well. I'm very glad to say. And speaking of Melvin Carter, I got a call from another Melvin Carter who happens to be the city council member who's in Atlanta, and he told me to express his support for Senator Moore and this bill. And so I have to say that. He said he would consider that important that it's said here. Okay. I have to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a retired St. Paul police officer, and I spent 28 years on the St. Paul Police Department, a bunch of years on patrol, a SWAT, a detective, entry team, and then I wound up in the Internal Affairs Division for 3 years in about 4 months and about 2 weeks. And I went into the Internal Affairs Division with a full head of hair. Thought it had a little levity to that. So I hope to offer a balanced perspective of this thing. You know, well, I mean, there's the issues of trust. The most sacred tool is that officers have to help us do our jobs. And I say us still because I took oath of office. Although I'm not active, you know, I still live to the oath. And the most important tool that officers have is the trust. And I don't hold public safety and officers' safety as either or. It has to be both, because if one feels unsafe, especially if police feel unsafe, everybody's unsafe. And so I don't see it as an either or thing. I was at a meeting last week and with a group of community elders. And the elders in the community were expressing contempt and distrust in the police department, in law enforcement. One white lady ended her statement with how she hated the police officers. With a boys group that I work with, a group of boys asked me, why do the police beat us? And I'm asking, who beat you? And they all chimed in, and they seemed to be asking from the perspective of really wanting to know the answer. A boy told me the story about how he was on probation for a curfew violation and truancy, and he did run from the police because they saw him. He expected to be caught and brought in, but he didn't expect him to beat him. And that's his story. I don't know, you know, and asked him if he made a complaint. He said, yes, he and his mother did, and it didn't do any good. Last year, under color of street gang task force, one mother of a young man named Justin Teagan sincerely believes that her son was executed under color of the gang task force. She believes that, and other people sincerely believe that. You know, it's a problem that they sincerely believe that. You know, there seems to have been the perception that the compromise, that the trust has been compromised. So let me ask you this question. If you believe that that law enforcement seized your rights, your property, and actually was capable of taking life, what would you advise your children? Would you tell your son to pull over when and where an officer stops you, or would you tell him to go to a lighter area? Or would you tell him to free for the life? Would you tell your child to allow the police to handcuff you if you thought that that he was going to be abused and beaten after he was handcuffed? Would you? Would you? What would you say? And so I say to you that there is an issue of public trust. This is a tough conversation. This is a courageous conversation it calls for. And what I know from my own perspective, and my perspective is that, you know, issues of comprehensive policies, procedures, and practices need to be in place across the spectrum of justice. They require oversight, and perhaps some level of transparency. I don't know that all of it needs to be transparent, because some of it lends itself to data privacy. Some of it lends itself to officers. I think officers need to be able to follow hunches and be able to share information to some extent. But I think the us against them line of policing is contrary to community policing. And the reason we have community policing in place in the first place is because we don't want to have military occupation. And so I leave it in your hands, and that's all I have to say about that at this time. But we have a problem, and we have to deal with it. And the perception that some of the things that people are saying, you know, of distrust, are things we need to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Mr. Parker.
Yes, my name's Troy Parker. My main reason for speaking today is Section 1, Subdivision 30, Line 1.7. It basically says individuals who are or may be engaged. And I think that is really vague language to be put into a law to allow people to then go down to, if you look at that same section, 1.12 and 1.13, they, you know, may be engaged, and then you're able to, just on a perception, begin to share that information with other agencies or individual, because then at some point you're crossing the line at violating my civil liberties, because now as I move or try to relocate into different areas or different locations, now I'm being tagged with that same or that type of perception is following me, even though I haven't probably did anything at my new location, or maybe that wasn't even true to begin with. So that's the only reason I rose to speak. I just thought that was pretty vague language to be allowing any institution or government agency or the public to do. Okay. And that's why I rose. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know Senator Moir wrote herself a note as you were talking. It'll be another piece that she'll be looking at. Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Senator Moir.
Madam Chair, I think that Mr. Parker is compelling in his case. I think maybe engaged is a little bit too vague, and I wonder if Ms. Pontius or the committee, for that matter, Madam Chair, could help me craft something here. I thought an amendment to the amendment that might be appropriate would be individuals who are known gang members, and then just strike the rest of it, I guess. That's what I was hoping to do, but I don't know.
So on line 1.7 of the amendment, you would strike or may be engaged in criminal gang activity and insert known gang members. Gang members. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. I don't know if that
narrows
quite
it significantly.
Strikes it.
Okay. And we will incorporate that into the A16 amendment. Okay. I think it's time to vote on the A16 amendment. All in favor of adopting the A16 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails. Do you have any other amendments before us?
Madam Chair, I have, I have two short amendments. I'd like to offer the A18 amendment, Madam Chair.
We'll get that passed out. You have a copy of it?
I do, Madam Chair.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and start explaining it?
Madam Chair, the A18 amendment is a substantial compromise from my bill as it left the Senate Judiciary Policy Committee. It restores and reinstates the operation of the gang pointer file in consideration and by request of the different local law enforcement jurisdictions who say that its elimination would tie their hands and their ability to do multi-jurisdictional work. I'm obviously it's not my preferred place to be, Madam Chair, but this is a reluctant compromise with the law enforcement community.
Okay. Discussion on, so it would delete sections 7 and 12 of the bill. Any discussion on the amendment?
Just a point of clarity, maybe.
Senator Ingebretson.
Point of clarity on the repealer section 12. Can you go through that for me just real quickly, Senator?
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebretson, the repealer was the repealer to all the language and the statutes that enacted the gang pointer file system. And so we're just deleting the repealer, therefore reinstating the gang pointer file system.
Now, remind me, Senator Moore, gang net is run by
the Ramsey County system.
Gang pointer is run by
the BCA, and it's created by state statute with a 10-point criteria. In order for somebody to be in that system, they would have had to be convicted of a felony. There is an audit process in place of the two system. I think that the gang pointer file system, though, is a system that deserves to be looked at a second time. I think that there is potentially a better way to achieve what the gang pointer file is intended to achieve. I've had conversations with the BCA about that, and I am confident in the commitment from the superintendent and the commissioner to re-examine the utility of the gang pointer file and to come back to us with a recommendation.
Any other discussion on this amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the A18 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say no. Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, I want to put before the committee the A15 amendment. If a member of the committee would like to move the A15 amendment, to be fair and out of respect for and at the request of Sheriff Stanek, I'm putting the A15 amendment before you. I will not be moving the amendment, but I am putting this before you. In the paragraph with respect to the usage of technology by local law enforcement, in section, the last, let's see, let me refer to that section. Maybe Ms. Pontius can help us here. So page 10.
Madam Chair, it's section 8.
Section in section 8 of the bill, it is a requirement for local law enforcement in their usage of a particular technology to have to go to their local elected boards. So in this matter, the township board or the city or the county county board to have a discussion and seek approval. Sheriff Stanek came to see me, and he said that he, too, is an elected official, and he had some concerns about having to seek approval for another elected body. I think that an issue that's of this significant, that the more publicly elected individuals we bring into the conversation, the better off the public is in terms of being able to have some opportunity for discussion and oversight. I made a commitment to him that I would take that under advisement and consideration. I have the amendment drafted. We are not at the same place, but I did make a commitment to him that I would take that under consideration. I'm bringing that decision to this committee. It is before the committee.
Is there anybody who'd want to offer the A15 amendment, Senator Limerick?
Chair, I want to ask a question or two.
Sure, go ahead, because I have a couple as well.
This exception is being recognized only for a county sheriff office. Are there other law enforcement agencies that have this type of equipment or a request for this equipment? Why wouldn't we treat them all the same? Why is a county sheriff so unique?
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Senator Lemmer, I agree with you. So that's why I'm not offering the amendment. But Sheriff Stanek was very respectful and came and had a respectful conversation with me. And out of respect for him, I'm putting the amendment before the body for a debate.
And Senator Moore, I believe I read in the newspaper just this week that the sheriff did go to the county board and ask for permission to get this software. And the first meeting, there was no resolution of it. But I believe just this in the past week, they have approved the acquisition of this software. So I'm not sure why it's even before us. Is there anybody who wants to move this amendment?
Maybe, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer's question could be answered from the Sheriff's Association representative, if that'd be all right.
Mr. Franklin, do you have knowledge that'll help us? Actually, somebody probably should try to move this amendment, or otherwise why are we talking about it? But Mr. Franklin, start by identifying yourself, please.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. Would you like to move the amendment first before I say anything, or just...
Is there anybody who'd like to move
it? I'll move it.
Okay, Senator Ingridson will move it. Okay, Mr. Franklin.
The question was asked with regards to the issues of a difference between a sheriff and a elected or a public safety officer or a police chief. The sheriff is elected by all of the people of the county. As you know, county commissioners are usually sectioned off and elected by one-fourth, one-fifth, one-seventh of the population. The county sheriff and the county attorney must be elected by all of the people of the county. The second issue is that the county attorney and the county sheriff have the right of appeal of their budget. A budget is set by the county board. When that budget is set at the beginning of a budget year, there is a time period in which the county attorney and county sheriff must make a decision if the resources provided by the county are adequate in order to serve the public safety needs of the public. If they are, and no appeal is made within 15 days, then the budget moves forward and the expenditures are brought forward by the sheriff in accordance with the budget as is. Under those circumstances and under circumstances as presented by this bill, it would be difficult for a sheriff if there were a purchase or something that came through a different avenue to bring that back to the county board. And that is the issue or the difference between a public elected sheriff that brings forth expenditures versus and how that ties to the budgeting versus a police chief who is hired by either one of the four or five city forms of government, most oftentimes city manager, city clerk, or mayor, and then they are hired, fired, and all of their approval process goes through their respective city council and administration. That's a very quick snapshot of the differences here.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Sheriff Franklin. How do you want me to address you? Director Franklin?
Yes, that's fine.
All right.
First
of all, to whom would such an appeal go? I'm just not familiar with that process. And secondly, as a situation, as you know it, in Hennepin County, the only reason Sheriff Stanek had to go to the county board was because he needed the funds in order to purchase the Kingfish. Or if he had gotten complete federal funding for it, could he have done it without going to the county board for approval?
Mr. Franklin?
Madam Chair, and Senator, I'm not exactly sure of all the nuances of Hennepin County. I will try to answer it as best that I know it in general. The first question you asked was, to whom is the appeal process made? Basically, to the county board first, if not there, to the district court would be the ultimate. But we start with a process to work those things out. They could go to mediation. They could settle it other different ways. There's multiple avenues. As regard to the Hennepin situation, I'm not sure I'm fully informed on that. My assumption is, based on what little knowledge I have and or what you've said, is I am assuming that there would be a commingling of perhaps some federal funding that would be coming in and potentially, as you've indicated, some county funding that would be over and above the current funding. In that particular case, they would then need the authorization of the county board to accomplish that.
Senator Bergman.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, doesn't it seem to you like what would happen is when the sheriff's department goes before the county board with their budget, that they would have this piece of equipment itemized in their budget in order to get the approval that the law would require? So it's not like there would be an extra burden.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, I have thought those things through. That's why I'm not offering the amendment.
All right, Senator Ingebretson moves the A15 amendment. Is there any further discussion?
Yes, one more question, please.
Senator Ingebretson.
Madam Chair, so to understand this properly, Mr. Franklin, the county sheriff, according to this amendment, then would be exempt does not apply to county sheriffs. I guess the question would be: is the jurisdiction of the county, are if it's purchased by the sheriff, are the cities within the location of the county are going to be using that device? Is that a fair question to ask on this amendment?
Senator Ma?
Madam Chair, I guess I don't understand the question. So, Senator Ingebretson, can you restate your question?
Well, Senator Ingebretson.
Go ahead. It was part of your question, I think, to start with.
I think what Senator Ingebretson is trying to ask is if only a sheriff's office has the jurisdiction to use this equipment and not follow the prescription we put into law, any other law enforcement agency, let's say like a large city like the city of Minneapolis, they have to use the requirements as we dictate in law. And if, let's say they don't have the equipment or if they don't want to use this, do they go and get it from the sheriff who doesn't have to follow the direction that we're prescribing in law?
Senator Limmer? I think so.
Okay. On the amendment,
Senator Limmer. We need to dig into this a little bit. Because also in the provision of law is on line 1027. Those were the requirements to use this type of equipment.
Yep.
Either one, you had to, if I remember right, get a search warrant or as reflected in the number clause number 2 on line 1027, or number 4, clause 4, would be the permission of the owner of the phone to search for the use of this cellular equipment. I've been told by Sheriff Stanek that he actually has to get a court order as opposed to a search warrant in order to pursue. It's different. I don't know all the details between court order and search warrant, but I am a little more comfortable that at least a magistrate's involved in the use of this equipment rather than just a law enforcement agent acting on their own in searching for
Madam
for that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
But
the amendment only
exempts the sheriff.
That's right.
From having to go to his county board for approval.
For purchase. Right.
It doesn't exempt the second paragraph.
It does not exempt the use of this type of equipment from coming under wiretap statutes in the state.
It doesn't. I'm sure. It does. Say that again.
Senator, it does not exempt the usage of this type of technology by anybody from the wiretap laws of this state. So the wiretap laws of this state applies to any law enforcement agencies.
Right.
The carve-out request here by Sheriff Stanek is that because sheriffs are elected officials, that they don't want to have to go ask the board, the county board, for approval of the purchase of the technology. Whether that is with other people's money or their own money. And the reason why I'm hesitant about that is that then it sort of circumvents the whole idea of being able to perhaps bring in a broader group of electeds to have some oversight. But.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lehman?
In your discussion, Senator Moi, was there a reason not to have a governing board? Even maybe a governing board is the improper relationship with a sheriff that I'm characterizing, but is it, what would be wrong about having an elected panel of people, whether it's in the legislature or whether it's in a city council or whether it's in a county? Why would it be wrong for them to know what equipment is being purchased in their jurisdiction for law enforcement?
Senator Lehman, it sounds to me like you're a vote against this amendment.
Well, I'm just trying to understand it before I do vote, but yeah. I may be leaning in that direction. Yeah. I don't understand why. What's the big deal?
Senator. Well, Madam Chair and Senator Lehman, I guess that's part of the conversation to be had with the work group.
All right, let's vote on the A15 amendment, please.
Madam Chair, if I could have one more question before I may even withdraw it, actually.
Okay, Senator Ingridson.
We have the sheriff's representative here, not the chiefs. Give me a sense of where they're at with this. Would they like this as a whole? My fear is that we're strapping the office of sheriff here by not allowing him to or she to be able to purchase the equipment to effectively fight law enforcement. With the existing in the existing bill, Senator, does that sound right too? Maybe that's a double question. Are you strapping the office of sheriff with this bill without this amendment? Excuse me,
Madam Chair,
purchasing that equipment,
Senator Wall.
That's right. I am requesting, requiring that all law enforcement who want to purchase this equipment go to the elected body that governs that jurisdiction. The carve-out is your amendment then makes an exception for sheriffs, but everyone else still has to go through that approval process.
Okay. Senator Ingraham?
I'll stand with my amendment.
Okay. We're going to vote on the A15 amendment offered by Senator Ingraham. All in favor of adopting the A15 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Madam Chair,
Senator Moore.
I think that that's enough, but that's all that I have before the committee. I know that the commissioner wanted to testify on the whole bill.
Okay.
There might, you know.
Now would be the time. Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Commissioner Campion.
Madam Chair, very brief. Michael Campion, again, Commissioner of Public Safety. The other provisions of the bill, we have worked with Senator Moore extensively. We support those provisions. We understand the accountability and change in the council and all those matters. I do want to give Senator Moore an awful lot of credit. She She's been very receptive to us for a long period of time. She's made some overtures here and some amendments that I think will offer us an opportunity to make this bill better and the information that law enforcement needs better. We are not insensitive to communities that have been impacted by the Metro Gang Strike Force. I think Chief Harrington spoke eloquently and was on point regarding that. The fact that we need to have community support is vital. We recognize that. As someone who was involved in this Metro Gang Strike Force from the first day, I understand the negative impact to communities of color, and we will work earnestly and diligently between now and the next legislative session to put together and achieve the goals that Senator Moore has in her bill, in her amendment.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Senator Moore, Mr. Franklin, did you want to say a wrap up as well? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Jim Franklin again speaking today on the bill, speaking on behalf of the Sheriff's Association, the Police Chiefs Association, and the MPPOA. I want to thank Senator Moore and everyone that's worked on this. You can see how complicated and difficult this issue is just by your discussion today. And we knew that coming in, that it was going to be a very difficult discussion, very complex discussion. And I think, as Senator Mao has alluded to, the current Section 1, what does it mean? I think we all have some very serious questions. And I think with regards to the amendment that was made, I think we need to have some additional discussion, and we will certainly do that, and we welcome that opportunity. I think Mr. Carter today summarized the issue of trust. In my mind, there's no question everybody has the vision of how to protect public safety in Minnesota and the desire that we want to do that. I think where we're coming from and the avenues that we're using are different, and we desperately need communication and understanding. This is a very complex subject. We look forward to working on this together. There's a number of issues. We're going to try and do our very best to be supportive in the spirit of cooperation. I just want everybody to understand, these are complex issues. How many years did it take us to build up and put together data practices laws? And if we can get this all done in a year-plus time frame, great. But if we can't, I just trust that there's a spirit of cooperation that we continue to work on it and do it right. Not fast, but get it right, because I think we need it to serve our communities, all of our communities, as we meet the challenges that face us in the upcoming future. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
So, Mr. Franklin, are you in favor, the groups that you represent, are they in favor of this bill, the way it's amended?
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, Senator, we certainly have some work to do to bring everybody on board, and I believe the good senator would agree with me, there's a lot of people here that have to be brought on board, and we all have probably some sales work that we need to do to keep this group together. Again, focusing on communication, how we do it together. We are going to suggest that we do move forward today, but we do have some reservations that we'll talk with the senator about. And we have some concerns as to how long this is going to take us, but we're going to do our very best to work together. I think there's some things out there that can be done, and we're going to work very diligently to do it and do it right.
And Senator Moore, I want to thank you, because you have had a monumental task, and this has such importance all over our communities, the communities you represent, I represent, all of us here in the state. And I would have thrown up my hands and run. And you're still here trying to make sure that it's right. And thank you for doing that.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Any other comments? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Franklin, thank you for those comments. And you're right. We have to move cautiously here, because a lot of good work has been done by the practitioners out there. I can attest to that. But at the same time, when we do lose trust, that has to be, unfortunately, it takes some time to get that back. I just do have one real quick question, if I could, because this pertained to a bill that Senator Moore and I actually teamed up on a couple years ago. It was on page 3 of the bill. I see we're deleting the senator and the representative on the task force that you and I actually teamed up on. And I actually thought it was pretty good work. I'm wondering why it's being taken out. And how has those meetings gone? Who's on them? I don't even know.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, every committee, a legislator asked that question. And in my mind, I say, well, then should we appoint you to sit on it? That's just the reason why we left out the legislative member is that this is an oversight council that has the responsibility to act to provide oversight. And maybe in other task forces or council where it's informational or policy-driven, it's appropriate to have a member of the legislature on it so that we are informed and that we can bring the policy discussions back to the legislature for changes in the law. But this advisory council acts more as an oversight capacity. And I think if there were ever another incident like the one we faced this summer, really, which implicated the duties of the Oversight Council to exert itself to provide oversight to this Metro Gang Strike Force. I think that legislative members then are challenged as to how they sit on the Oversight Council and didn't provide that oversight, but then how are they now going to then, in this capacity, put the Oversight Council under scrutiny for failing to do their job. So I'm not saying that legislative members shouldn't sit on these councils. You and I, we have both sit on a couple of them. I just think that in this case, it might be prudent to remove the legislative members.
Yes. Okay. Are we ready to vote?
Yes.
I think we are.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2725 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the full Committee on Finance.
Okay, on that motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We are adjourned.
Goodness.